Child safety in your church is a wise message by L. Clark, Foursquare Corporate Attorney. This message was recorded at Bringing to Truth to Life, an intensive for Christian educational leaders, held at Life Bible College, sponsored by the National Department of Foursquare Christian Education.
I found 6 years ago when I came to work at headquarters as the only attorney on staff and the only attorney that ever worked at headquarters that I was quite often the butt of the joke. Everybody loves to go after attorneys. And I quickly realized that the best defense is an offense. So I began telling attorney jokes faster than anybody else could and became kind of known for that. And I don't want to break that tradition this morning, so I just, while the last few people come in, I want to just give you one to take home with you. It seems that a minister and an attorney were chatting at a party, and the minister asked the attorney, he said, "What do you do if you make a mistake on a case?" And the attorney said, "Well, if it's a big one, I try to fix it. But if it's not significant, well, then I just go on." "Well, what do you do?" The minister replied, "Well, more or less the same thing." He said, "Let me give you an example. Said, the other day I was preaching and I meant to say the devil is the father of lies. But instead I said the devil is the father of lawyer. But it didn't seem like a big deal, so I just let it go on." Well, I'm glad to be here this morning. Children and Christian education have been a concern to me and a matter of the heart since my earliest times in ministry. As Rick mentioned to you, I was originally on staff with Tom and Rhonda Ferguson at Everett, Washington. And my first, all right, say hello to everybody back there for me, would you? My first assignment for Tom on staff was to head up our Christian education program. And at that point in time, we were busting at the seams and running double services, and in order to do double services, we did double Sunday schools. So that as each service was running, we had a Sunday school running parallel, and making as best use of our space as we possibly could. Well, that meant we had a Sunday school staff of about 50 teachers. And with that many teachers, there was always the need to be recruiting. I had no more than get one hole plugged in another. I mean, it was like trying to plug a leaky boat. You know, there was just always a new leak springing. Yeah. Can anybody relate to that? Okay. The rest of you, maybe you're in the wrong seminar. I don't know. Because I think that's a universal problem. I was also the youth pastor, and we had a youth group of about 125 kids or so, and so I was having to recruit people to assist me in that. And I have to tell you, this is true confession time, I have to tell you, in all of that recruiting, all of trying to keep those 50 Sunday school positions staffed and trying to recruit the people to assist in the youth program, never once did I do a background check. Just didn't occur to me. Wasn't even on the screen. Off the radar completely. And I'm happy to report that, to my knowledge, there were no incidents that would have provoked concern. Now, does that mean that my procedures and my philosophy were adequate? No. It just means that God is gracious. Amen? Well, the question that's facing all of us, Roger, if you give me that first slide, the question that's facing all of society was well phrased in a U.S. News and World Report cover of several years ago. The cover says, "Sexual predators, can they be stopped?" The whole society we live in is asking that question. When they're not stopped, and when that kind of predatory behavior occurs in the church, we see some incredible headlines occurring. Look at that next headline, Roger, if you'll put that up there. The headline, "Dozens of sexual molestation suits could force bankruptcy." And if we had time to read this article through, it would tell you, well, let me just read one paragraph. "In a letter read from pulpits or posted on bulletin boards in 91 parishes and missions throughout New Mexico," this would be Catholic parishes and missions, "the archbishop said that with the victims of sexual misconduct demanding $50 million in damages and the church's insurance company balking, bankruptcy looms ahead." Who could have ever imagined the day when the Catholic Church would be facing bankruptcy because of sexual molestation? And yet, this is not fiction. This is not John Gresham novel. These are headlines that are occurring, and unfortunately, we see them occurring frequently, don't we, in every newspaper around the country. Well, Let's get right into the meat of our subject here, and I've found that the best way to do it is the same way that I was taught in law school, which is to give examples and then try to work through those examples together. So, Roger, let's go to our first example there. Boy, you're not going to be able to read that at all, are you? Well, let me read this for you here. Just think this through with me. 2 years ago, Pastor Bob and Eddie met at a summer camp. Eddie was then 19. In conversations between Pastor Bob and Eddie at camp, the pastor learned that Eddie professed to have a calling to youth ministry, and that he was at the time not pursuing any particular career path. By observing Eddie, the pastor could see that Eddie was very popular and outgoing. Young people seemed to be drawn to Eddie. Pastor Bob encouraged Eddie to pursue God's will and calling on his life. 6 months later, Eddie showed up in the church. He told Pastor Bob that he had just moved into town and that he wanted to begin attending this church and be discipled by Pastor Bob. He also told the pastor that he was more persuaded than ever that God was calling him into full-time youth ministry. Pastor Bob found Eddie a place to live and a job and began to meet with Eddie weekly to disciple him. Well, the teens in the church were quickly drawn to Eddie. In a short time, Eddie established himself as the undeclared leader of the youth group. Seeing this, Pastor Bob began to give Eddie more and more authority and recognition until eventually, after another 6 months had gone by, Pastor Bob announced to the whole church that Eddie was the youth director. Prior to designating Eddie as the youth director, Pastor Bob did not receive from Eddie any kind of written application. Except for speaking with Eddie's former pastor, Pastor Bob conducted no background check of Eddie. Eddie's former pastor responded to Pastor Bob's inquiry vaguely by saying, well, there were some problems, but Eddie was enthusiastic and the youth group seemed to grow. Pastor Bob did not press for any further details. Now, three teenage boys are claiming that Eddie seduced them. Eddie has been arrested and has pled guilty to sexual assault on a minor. The three boys have each sued the church, and the story has made front page news in the local newspaper for the last several weeks. What went wrong? Now, just turn to your neighbor and in one sentence or two, tell him what went wrong. Okay, do that right now. You got it? Well, this story is meant to illustrate to you negligent hiring practices. And when I say hiring, I'm referring both to the hiring of paid staff and also to the hiring of volunteer staff. Because in the law, there's no distinction when it comes to this issue. So this story is meant to illustrate how not to do it. Negligent hiring practices. And unfortunately, this story is based in fact because we faced these lawsuits in Texas. And while I don't want to disclose to you the amount of money that it took to fully resolve the cases, I can tell you this, that we spent as an organization over $300,000 just paying our legal fees to defend the case. Now, what went wrong here was that Pastor Bob made a poor hiring decision. And he made a poor hiring decision because he failed to gather enough information to get all of the facts on which the decision should have been based. So let's look now at the rest of the story. Roger, give me that next slide. Well, let me just help you here. Here's the rest of the story. Here are the facts that could have been known. These facts came out during discovery phase of the litigation. It was learned Eddie came from a broken home and had been raised by a grandmother. Eddie had attended an independent Bible college in another city for one semester, but had dropped out when it was alleged that he kept pornography in his room, in his dorm room. Eddie had been the leader of the youth group of the church he had attended while he was in Bible college. He had left the church abruptly after being caught in a motel with a 14-year-old girl. Eddie had insisted that he was only counseling the girl. The trouble that the former pastor vaguely alluded to in the conversation with Pastor Bob related to the fact that Eddie had refused to submit to the pastor in directing the youth group. Eddie insisted that God spoke to him directly about how to lead the youth group and that the senior pastor should not interfere. Now, let's face it, none of us would have hired Eddie to be the youth leader if we had that information in hand, would we? All of that information could have been known without spending a penny except the cost of a few long-distance phone calls. All of that information should have been known. And the failure to learn it before hiring Eddie is what the law says is negligence. So let's look a little bit closer at the concept of negligent hiring. in the next slide. And I've also given you a handout. If you'll look for the handout that says legal basis for liability. You got that in front of you? Negligent hiring, in a nutshell, occurs when the church fails to act responsibly in the selection of its paid or volunteer workers. The church fails to act responsibly in the selection of its paid or volunteer workers. Let me ask you a question. Would you be alarmed if you took your car to a mechanic shop to have the brakes repaired and you knew that the mechanic that was going to fix your brakes, it was his first day on the job, and that in fact the senior owner of the shop had made no inquiry of the mechanic's background to see if he knew anything about brakes? Would that concern you? Well, of course it would. Because if your brakes don't work and your car can't stop, you could kill somebody. You could be killed. You would call it extremely negligent, gross negligence, for a mechanic to be offered the opportunity to work on your car and fix your brakes who knew nothing about brakes. You depend on the owner of the shop to make sure he's got qualified mechanics working on your car. Why would we think selection of youth workers would be any different? The same principle applies exactly. Well, now, let's ask ourselves the question then, how do we make a good hiring decision? How do we make a good selection? Whether it's a paid worker or a volunteer, the process is the same. Good decisions don't happen by accident. Good decisions don't happen by chance. Good decisions are the result of good policies and good procedures that are decided beforehand and then followed in the processing of the application. So the first step is that the church has to have a child safety policy. A child safety policy is the church's statement of its philosophy and its intentions about protecting the children that God gives it to care for. And in the manual that you've been given by the CE department, Your Church, A Safe Place for Children, there's a section there beginning on page 9 where we give you the step-by-step process that you can follow in your church for building a child safety policy in your church. Selecting the team that's going to build it, working it through, the decisions that you have to make, the issues that have to be addressed, and then the process of propagating it to the congregation so that by the end of the whole process, you've built an awareness level in the church and a consensus in the church so that the entire church is on board. This is a philosophy that we as a congregation have adopted and that we're united in seeing carried out. And that process is going to take some time. I would say typically it will take you from day one at least 6 months to go through the whole process of developing this process, developing the policy, and then educating first your core leaders and then the Sunday school staff and the CE staff and then the congregation at large of what that policy is and why it's needed. Well, after we have a policy, then we have to have procedures that are followed in selecting workers that are consistent with that policy. Well, procedures are the practical steps that are required to get information. And our first procedure is that we've got some preset, predetermined minimum standards to start with. Thank you, Roger. For example, in our policy, we're going to decide what are our minimum age requirements. Are we comfortable with a 14-year-old teaching Sunday school? Frankly, I'm not. Well, do we have a minimum attendance requirement? Can I come to your church and after only 2 weeks be given the opportunity to teach your children? I don't think so. Well, if that's not the standard, what is the standard? Well, we will have decided that in our policy so that at the very beginning of the procedure process, we already know what our minimum requirements are, our minimum standards. Now, how are we going to know if the applicant meets those minimum standards? Well, to begin with, we're going to take a written application from him. And from this point on in the process, I'm going to be referring to some forms that have already been given to you, beginning in Appendix A, starting on page 27 of your manual. These forms have been carefully worked out, and frankly, you can take them, photocopy them, use them, and they should do what they've been designed to do for you. So we're going to take a written application. Now, I have been heartened to learn that most of our churches do already take written applications when they're recruiting staff people to work in their Christian education program. What discourages me is to learn that nothing is done with the application. How do you know that the information on the application is true? If you were a sexual predator and had a criminal record, would you put that on your application? I wouldn't, because I know you'd disqualify me. So I'm going to lie on my application. I'm going to leave things out. I'm going to be a little bit sketchy. I'm going to kind of, you know, fudge and finesse and hedge and hope that you don't do anything to verify the information, so you're never going to know. So that's the next step. After we have our written application, we have to take the action that's needed to arrive at verification. That means that I'm going to call or write places of prior service. If on the application he says that he worked for the Boys Club in Toledo, I want to know what the Boys Club in Toledo has to say about him. If he says that he was a Sunday school teacher at the Brownsville Baptist Church, I want to know what the Brownsville Baptist Church has to say about him. I want to also contact his personal references. If he says that Bob Smith, elder at Brownsville Baptist, is his best friend, I want to talk to Bob Smith. And then I'm going to talk to the pastors of all the prior churches that he's attended, certainly in the last 5 years. And last but not least, as a matter of fact, far from least, if I had to do one thing and one thing only, the one thing that I would do is that I'm going to do a criminal records check. I'm going to find out what involvement this individual has had with the law to see if there's anything in his background that would reflect negatively on his fitness to work with my tender children. Now, all of that's going to take time. All of that's going to take a little work. All of that, I will confess, is going to increase the burden of what's involved in recruiting, because it means that you cannot recruit somebody on Wednesday and start them on Sunday. But what is the alternative? I don't see one. More importantly, in the present state of the law, as far as what duty is being imposed on us by law, there is no alternative. We are required by law to make responsible decisions of who we use. And there's just no way to make a responsible decision without information. Verified, accurate information. Now, after you've done all this, and you have the information, you've conducted your interview, you've got all the things in hand, you know you've got a good worker, so you're going to put him to work, you're going to train him, etc., and then put him to work or put her to work. What are you going to do with all that information? Well, we're certainly not going to disclose it to people. And this is probably pretty much confidential information. Are we going to shred it? No. These are, unfortunately, virtually permanent records. I call them semi-permanent records, and by semi-permanent, what I'm saying is you're probably going to have to keep them for upwards to 20 years. And the reason I say that is if Billy, who's age 5, wants to bring a lawsuit claiming that he was sexually molested, do you know how long Billy has to do that in California? He has any time until he's age 19. So in California, I might have to produce the records, well, if he's age 5, age 19, 14 years after I've selected that teacher, I might have to produce records to show the diligence that I used in selecting the teacher that Billy is accusing. If Billy's 4, it would be 15 years. 3, 16 years. How about if I'm not in California, I'm in Indiana? Well, in Indiana, there's a 3-year statute of limitations, and the 3 years does not begin to run until the child reaches 18. And so, in fact, Billy has until his 21st birthday to bring a lawsuit. So you see why I'm saying these are semi-permanent records? It could be a long, long, long time after you make the selection process that you would be called upon to demonstrate to a jury that the process you used had due diligence in it. So we have to keep these records, and that imposes another whole problem. that has to do with storage of records and safekeeping the confidentiality of the records. But again, what's the alternative? I don't know one. If I knew one, and when I find one, I will tell you. But right now, the only safe harbor I can give you is to say, keep these records, keep them under lock and key, keep the records, and if you want to know how and when to dispose of them, I would say you're going to have to start tracking what age group the teacher taught, so that you can extrapolate from there when the statute of limitations will have finally run, and then set up an indexing system so that in 1999 we're now able to destroy the records from 1979. Okay? All right, let's go forward a little now that I've thoroughly discouraged you. Anybody feel like you're drowning? Okay. Well, that's good. That means you're understanding what's going on. All right. Well, everything we've talked about so far has to do with negligent hiring. And you're going to be tested in this selection process. Let me give you a couple of examples of a test where you'll be sorely tempted and tried to bend your own rules, to deviate from what you've just decided. Here's test number one. Betty, now age 50 or something, has taught junior high girls since anyone can remember. Betty is a pillar of the church. She wants to continue teaching but is refusing to complete a written application or to be fingerprinted for background checking. In fact, she is angry at the entire notion and is letting you, the church leadership, and anyone else who will listen to her know of her displeasure. Should you permit Betty to teach children without doing any background check on her? Well, that's a tough one. Nobody wants to offend Betty. But the truth is, if you give an exception to Betty, that's the first step down a slippery slope. If Betty, who's taught for 20 years, gets a pass, what about Bill that's taught for 10? And if you're going to accept Bill that's taught for 10, how about Jim who's taught for 2? And pretty soon, you're now being accused of selectively deciding who you trust and who you don't, not based on objective information, but based on some sort of subjective standard that nobody's really quite sure of. And you're going to have a lot more people angry with you than just Betty. The only solution to this is turn Betty around. Help Betty understand how much of a leader she is and how her opinion influences other people. And let's let Betty be the one who leads the parade. We've got to help Betty to understand how important this is so that Betty can be an ally in the process. All right, here's another test. Richard has attended the church for 5 years. For most of that time, he's been rather lukewarm in his spiritual walk and has been uninvolved in church except for regularly attending morning services. But beginning with the spiritual renewal conference of a year ago, Richard has really begun to grow in his faith. He has been genuinely transformed. Today, in a counseling situation, Richard has told you that he wants to work with the Church Royal Ranger Boys Program. He's also disclosed to you that several years before he began to attend the church, he was accused and convicted of molesting a 10-year-old girl. Richard says it was all a terrible misunderstanding that occurred between he and his next-door neighbors of the time. Richard claims that when he was arrested, he pled not guilty, but he was poorly represented by his attorney, those attorneys, and was wrongly convicted. He was placed on 18 months probation. He served the probation. The probation has been ended long ago. It's been years since, and he's now clean. Should you permit Richard to work with the Royal Rangers? How many say yes? How many say no? How many need another cup of coffee? The problem here is that Richard is very, very vulnerable to a false accusation. I hate to say it, but right now we live at a point in time when society is so sensitized to this issue that society, the police, the courts, psychological, mental health workers, the whole gamut, the whole system knee-jerks and reacts in favor of protecting the child. And they do that by running ahead and making conclusions. And as a result, I'm sure many people are routinely falsely accused, falsely convicted, and it's just not fair to Richard or to the reputation of your church to put him in a situation where a false accusation would be believed because of an incident that occurred 5 or 6 years ago in his life. So we've got to help Richard to see that there are other ways to serve and that God is pleased with his heart, but that we in good conscience cannot put him in a place where he would be vulnerable to such a tremendous risk. Everyone's going to try to carve out an exception. Once you begin down that road, your policy is out the window. All right. Now, let's digress a little bit from negligent hiring to the next problem that occurs, and that is, what do you do after you've got them hired? Okay, here's a situation for you. Charlie has been a volunteer youth leader for about a year. Charlie is age 21 and doesn't have a whole lot of experience, but he sure loves the Lord. Recently, at a youth lock-in, Charlie confessed to you that things got somewhat out of hand. The lock-in was attended by about 50 kids, boys and girls. The volunteer assistants that Charlie had recruited to help failed to show up. The kids got very unruly because Charlie lost control. It is rumored that some of the kids left the event and didn't return for hours. But of most concern is Charlie's admission that a 15-year-old girl came on to him. Charlie pushed her away, but not before he returned her kiss. The girl's parents have heard of the incident, and they are furious. They're demanding that a police report be filed. What went wrong? Give somebody your first impression of what went wrong. Turn to your neighbor there. Well, let me hear a couple of you tell me what you think what went wrong. Just one-liners, just kind of like popcorn here. Tell me what went wrong. Okay, should have canceled the event because he didn't have enough supervision. No accountability. Poor planning. Okay, well, you guys are right on the money here. This little hypothetical, this little illustration is meant to illustrate negligent supervision. Don't be too quick to blame Charlie. Was Charlie given a job description? A written job description? Did he even know what he was supposed to be doing? Was Charlie given the policy guidelines of the church for events? Did he know, for example, what's the ratio that the church requires of adult to child supervision? Was it 8 to 1, 10 to 1, 2 to 1? Did Charlie know how many students were going to attend? Was Charlie reporting to anyone in event planning? All of these are questions we don't know. But those are the kind of questions that an attorney representing that girl are going to ask in trying to decide not whether Charlie was negligent, but whether the church was negligent in supervising Charlie. Because, see, the attorney knows Charlie don't have two nickels to rub together. He doesn't care anything about suing Charlie. He wants to sue the church because that's where the money is. And to get to the money, he's got to show that the church was negligent in selecting Charlie, or that the church was negligent in supervising Charlie. So we have an obligation to make sure that Charlie knows his job and that Charlie is carrying out his job correctly. That's called supervising. And we can't carry out that responsibility until we decide what his job is and inform him of it. And then work with him to see that it's done by the numbers. I have to tell you, in all the years that I was a CE leader or a youth director, I never once had a pastor sit down with me and say, "Now, what's your plan if something goes wrong? What's plan B?" This didn't happen. Well, this little hypothetical is also meant to illustrate another whole subject of conversation called child abuse reporting. Every state in all of the 50 states has a law on its books that requires incidents of suspected or known child abuse to be reported to legal authorities. Do you know, as you sit here this morning, for your state, are you a mandatory reporter? In some states, clergymen are. In a few states, clergymen are not. If you are a mandatory reporter, do you know what the state law is for your state, for what triggers your duty to make a report? It's not the same for every state. And once that duty is triggered, do you know how to carry out that duty? You should, because that's part of your job. Now, I have some good news for you. I have just completed the research to compile what the child abuse reporting statute is for all 50 states. And I'm going to have that updated to include any amendments to those statutes through the end of 1998, and I'll have that completed within the next 60 days and be able to distribute that in some fashion. Rick and I were talking this morning about how the best way to do that would be. But we're going to put in your hands, or we'll put it, at least put in the hands of every senior pastor, the child abuse reporting requirements that govern he and his staff in the state where the church is located. So that you don't have to wonder, you don't have to guess. You can go to an easy-to-understand, simply written in plain language reference point and know what you're supposed to do. I'm excited about that because that's a resource that I have seen the need for some time now, and it thrills me to be able to put that resource in the hands of our pastors, our churches, and all of our CE people like you wonderful people. Let's take a moment then and summarize what we've seen as far as child abuse. And the summary you'll find on the handout that's called Basic Prevention. Our first point simply says, in stating a six-month rule, that really has to do with the fact that we're going to have some minimum standards. We're going to have a policy that gives us the minimum standards. And one of those minimum standards is going to be 6 months at least before you can serve with children. And then we're going to have proper procedures. We're going to have pre-screening procedures for we're going to have forms, we're going to do background checks, we're going to check with other organizations, we're going to check his personal references, we're going to check with other churches, we're going to check his criminal records. And I'm also pleased to tell you this. I have been in negotiation with several national organizations to do criminal records checks for all of our churches and to do that at a very modest cost. I think the cost will be somewhere around $15. And the turnaround time, like 72 hours. I'm going to be taking that to the president the first opportunity and seeing if we can put that into place. But I would hasten to tell you that that's only a backup for what I hope you've already identified as available resources locally. In some states, California being one of those states, in some states you can go to the criminal justice department of the state and get a background check done for no cost at all. Now, it isn't quite as quick as 72 hours, but the fact of it being a free service makes it a very useful service that the state provides for churches and religious organizations and other organizations that work in the nonprofit sector. So I hope you have already been doing some checking to see what is the most cost-effective way for you to do background checks in your local area. But if that's still been a problem for you, I hope in the very near term to be able to announce or to have the president announce that we have entered into an agreement that will allow good background checks to be done on a nationwide basis at a very modest cost. So that's right in the forefront here. Well, we have a written policy that has mandatory reporting and zero tolerance. We're going to educate our staff, we're going to educate our volunteers, and we're going to educate our congregation so that we're moving together, we're not pulling against each other. And then finally, and I don't have time to really pursue this, but as a final comment here, there are some things that we can do just in the physical properties of our campus that will make child abuse something that's hard to accomplish. Just simple things like putting windows into doors that are used so that uh, so that a roving monitor during the church hours when child activities are going on can simply walk by, look in the door, and without disturbing the class, visually see what's going on. That would be a big help. Simple things like keeping doors locked that are not in use, so that there are not places of seclusion that a person can take a child off by themselves. These are just simple things that can be done that will make the opportunities less, because the places where an opportunity would be utilized don't exist. So that can, those are easy to do and easy to put into place. Before we turn it over to questions, I want to just take a moment to shift gears here, because I wouldn't want you to think that child safety is exclusively about child sexual abuse. I mean, that is a big dollar concern, but it's not the only way that child safety is an issue. And one of the issues that are addressed in your booklet, your workbook, is the whole area of AIDS and HIV, and I don't even have time to go into that, but I do encourage you to read that so that your child safety policy can include how to minister to a child that's been diagnosed as having a contagious disease. And we want to minister to that child. We want to minister to that child's family. But let me just look at one more hypothetical for you to make my point about child safety being a bigger issue than just child molestation. Follow this hypothetical for me. Larry, a 28-year-old youth pastor, stared at the swollen river on the other side of the parking lot. How was he supposed to know that this weekend the water from the reservoir was going to be released into the river? What was he going to do? Run the river or drive home? In the parking lot was the church van full of teenagers straining to begin the long-awaited river rafting trip. The owner of the outfitter's shop had just told Larry that only experienced canoers had any business on the river on a day like this. Larry was also thinking of the excited kids and the three-hour driving that had been required to haul the rack of canoes out to the river for this outing. The van was rocking. The kids were psyched. Larry was feeling the pressure. Back at the van, Larry asked how many kids had canoeing experience. No hands went up. With a look of resignation and a slight laugh, Larry shouted, "Let's go for it." Within minutes of hitting the river, almost every canoe had capsized. Everyone was soaked and shivering in the frigid, fast-moving current. Several months later, the youth group was still retelling the stories of their great day on the river. The most memorable and laughable was Patty being so wet and cold that she turned blue and couldn't breathe. She didn't even have the strength to haul herself out of the river and back into the canoe. Only at home, hours later, was Patty able to warm up. Well, a parent overheard the conversations of the youth and approached Larry privately. He asked Larry if Larry had recognized Patty's symptoms as hypothermia. Did Larry know that Patty could have died that day? He questioned Larry's decision to canoe given the condition of the river and the inexperience of the kids. Larry deflected the parent's concern by assuring him that no one had gotten hurt. More important was the fact that the teens had a great time. Adventure is what makes a youth group exciting and attractive to unchurched kids. Driving home without canoeing would have hurt the positive image of the youth group, not to mention Larry. Larry added that he was confident God would protect them of any real danger. After all, we prayed. What could Larry have done? Well, again, I have to ask, what happened beforehand? What happened before the van ever pulled out of the church parking lot? Was there a safety committee that reviewed Larry's plans? Was there a time with the committee where the what-if game was played? Did somebody ever ask Larry, Larry, what if a van breaks down on the way to the river? What do you do? What's your plan? Larry, what if there's an accident, a collision, a traffic accident? What's your plan? Larry, what if one of the vans takes a wrong turn? Do they know how to get to the rendezvous point? What's your plan? Larry, what if the weather turns bad? What's your backup plan? Larry, what if the river is too high or too low? What's your plan? Larry didn't have another plan. But he could have. What should Larry have done? Well, at the river, when he saw that the water was absolutely unsafe, Larry could have done something like this. Hey, gang, I know we all wanted to go rafting today, but you know what? We can't do it. That's just not going to happen. That's dangerous out there. I love you guys too much to put you on the river. But you know what? This isn't a wipeout. There's a park about a mile down the road. You maybe saw it as we were driving in. Hey, we've got the Frisbees with us. We've got the softballs with us. We've got all the stuff. We got the food. We got everything we need to have a great day anyway. So let's go down there. We'll have a great outing. And we'll replan this through this canoe trip. I guarantee you the kids would have still had a wonderful time. And nobody would have been put at risk if Larry and the team that supervises Larry would have had some foresight to have a contingency plan prepared. Let me, in conclusion, say this. I'm haunted by what ifs. What if the lack of background checking that I did at Everett results 5 years from now with somebody claiming that they were molested when they were a kid? Statute of limitations isn't run yet on the work I did so long ago. What if Patty had died at the river without knowing Jesus? What if that boy that, those three boys that were molested in Texas are now so turned off to the Lord and to church that they never go back into another church? What if I have to stand before the Lord someday and explain these things? How will I do that? The creed that physicians are charged with when they take their oath to begin their career as doctors says, first, do no harm. Now we have a creed. We have a charge. Make disciples. Go ye therefore into all the earth and make disciples, teaching them whatsoever I have commanded you and baptizing them. That's our creed. That's our charge, our commission. But in there needs to also be, first, do no harm. We've got to do it well. These are children that are precious. And safety isn't an afterthought if it results in a death or in somebody having a change of attitude that absolutely hardens their heart to anything of the Lord. Safety is first. Thank you.